Bob Peterson has been rethinking schools for decades. Now he's running for the Milwaukee School Board. We will get his thoughts on that, and we kick off a new feature, Educated Educators Talking Education. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From theconversation.com, Sandy Hook lawsuit court victory opens up crack in gunmaker immunity shield. The Connecticut Supreme Court ruled on March 14th that families of the Sandy Hook Elementary mass shooting victims could proceed with a lawsuit against the companies that manufactured and sold the semi-automatic rifle used in the attack.
Wow. This is huge.
It is.
This is huge because for the longest time, in fact, 10 years, gun makers have been given an immunity type of situation here that they are not responsible for people misusing their products.
Correct.
And so the first answer is, well, how did they get around that?
Yeah, what's the loophole here?
What's the loophole here?
Right.
Okay, because obviously somebody for the Sandy Hook particularly went in, and the defense has always been, we just made the gun. We didn't make the guy crazy.
Right.
Okay. No, but how did you market the gun? And that's what's at play here, because there's a loophole in the word applicable, which turns into making the marketing is where we can now go after, in this case, Remington, because they marketed this gun as a weapon.
Marketed, advertised, and promoted for civilians to use to carry out offensive military-style combat missions against their perceived enemies.
Yeah.
That sounds big.
Right. So we're not plinking little targets at the gun range. We're not shooting animals to eat.
We're going these after are, perceived
these are
enemies.
Perceived enemies. And so this marketing then is at what's at play here. So now we can go after, according to this court ruling in Connecticut. Now, will it stand and will Remington be paying out billions? Not yet, because this will obviously have to make it to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. The question, though, that people are still continuing to wrestle with, and you and I even did it a little bit, is that should a manufacturer of a product be responsible for people using it incorrectly?
Right. And here's where I get, I don't understand the circumstances that the parents are going through by any means. I did not go through it. And I know they're looking for someone to blame. It almost mm-hmm. seems like, okay, we can go after them. We can go after them. Because where is their enemy.
Mm-hmm.
It's the kid that did it. It's maybe the families and now the gun maker. Now they're seeing this loophole. It seems like they just kind of keep going, because when is it going to be there?
Well, but is it that? And I'll come back and say, people have been asking for common sense gun laws because guns kill people. Okay. Mm-hmm. I know people say, no, people kill people. No, people without guns are less likely to kill people. When I hold a gun and I shoot you, I've shot you with a gun. So can we have common sense gun laws? And the answer's always been no. In fact, 10 years, just 10 years ago, we put in a law that specifically gave gun manufacturers immunity. So what was going on before this? So it becomes a political issue about saying, where does common sense gun laws start to be something that we should normally talk about? We're talking about babies here that were mass murdered by a killing machine. We seem to, you know, and it just happened again now in New Zealand. So the idea here is to say, at what point do gun manufacturers have some responsibility in at least making sure that they are not marketing for the wrong reasons?
From the WisconsinStateJournal.com, hundreds of students march on the state capitol to demand action on climate change. Unsatisfied with the state's response to climate change, more than 1,000 students from around the state marched on Friday at the state capitol to demand immediate action to confront the problem as part of the global youth climate strike.
Well, they're unsatisfied with the state's response to climate change. At this point, being from Wisconsin, there's been no response to climate change in Wisconsin.
Just not talking about
okay.
it.
So,
we've had too much snow to talk about climate change.
Well, in fact, that's how we know there's no climate change, according to some of the politicians, because it's snowing.
Right.
Okay? The difference for some politicians, they need to go back to fifth grade to get climate and a definition, and weather.
Oh, yes. Okay. Totally.
Weather is different than climate.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So weather can be all up and down, but a consistent change in the climate can be seen. And so there's climate change. Yeah. But it's students. The other criticism is, what are you doing with 13 to 17-year-old non-voters skipping school? Do they really know what they're talking about? Or was this just a play hooky day, Bonnie?
Well, see, here's the thing. As a field, if you kind of quote that as a field trip,
okay,
they're learning about state government. Mm-hmm. They're learning about
The state government's not very good.
That it's not very effective. They were learning who their legislators are.
Okay,
they were going to the state capitol. They were learning how to assemble, and they were learning to color in some great signs.
They made some awesome
great
signs. In
project.
Fact, go out there and look for one particularly that
it made the NBC nightly
made the
news.
NBC nightly news.
And it's a word you shouldn't say on television
right,
or radio
or radio
or in front of your parents.
But on a poster at climate change, it seemed
fine.
To be okay. But I like what you just said there, though, because I'm with you. It's, you know what? They're learning something about government.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've heard criticism of saying they should have been in school all day learning. And it's like, well, you know what? How about a day where they really learn,
right,
where they walk, where they got out in the cold? Some people, were there some kids there going like, hey, this is a free day off of school?
Sure.
Absolutely. Were there kids there, though, who learned something? Yes. And were there kids there who started off with thinking this is a free day off of school that came back anyway and learned something?
They accidentally learned.
Right.
Something.
Now, this is the fun part, though. So my daughter went, right? And I get the email from our school district saying, there's going to be a climate protest. If your son or daughter is going to participate, they cannot skip school because that will be illegal.
Oh.
I have to call her off to skip school. So I legally called her off to skip school for the climate change.
Oh, okay.
So no rules were broken at the Slecker household.
Good job.
Okay,
good
so
job.
When anybody saw my daughter at the protest, yes, she was there, but she was legally called off for skipping school that day, and she made an awesome sign. The earth is dying. We got to do something, and we got to keep trying.
From KGW.com in Portland, Oregon, money has been refunded after an auction at a Portland elementary school, which upset teachers and parents. Parents got to bid on their child's teacher for next year.
Hey.
That sounds fun.
What? It's just, how awesome, right?
I keep picturing one of those like bachelor auctions, and it's like, okay, number four,
step out. So you're the three fourth grade teachers, stand up there and get up in line and get up on the block.
Get up on the block, it's and we'll auction you.
It's like an auctioning block. And so parents are, you know, what's the square root of pi?
Right.
Okay. Semicolon or colon? Okay. Do you smoke?
Right. Tell me the geographic location of everything.
Right. So, but this is an interesting. This is just. If it weren't true, it would be The Onion. But it's true.
it sounds like an Onion story.
So a PTA person said, "Hey, this sounds like a great idea." In fact, in the stories, it was kind of like a spur of the moment is the word they're using.
It was spur of the moment, and the principal was like, "And
the
sure."
Principal spur of the moment said, "Sounds like a good idea to me too." My question is, what were they all doing before the spur of the moment that made them think that auctioning off teachers to the wealthiest parent is a good idea? I'm pretty sure that it sounds more like drunk teaching. Like drunk history, but we're not sure that happened. However, should it happen ever in a public school is the issue here. And so as an elementary school teacher that I used to do, right, I was one of four fifth grade teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and at the end of the year, I got my class list of the current fourth graders that were coming up. How was it determined as to who I got and my next door neighbor, Mr. Weakling, got, and all so on, right? All these questions.
There was an auction nobody told you about.
Auction, right?
This one just made it public.
That's how I got that kid.
Yep.
The parent didn't pay anything.
Short straw.
No, we do these things. We hopefully do this with fairness so that each parent regardless of the financial situation that they're in, their kid gets, quote, the best education, right. And you can't pay for this. And it's interesting now because we are seeing this kind of, you know, right now as we see wealthy celebrity parents paying for mm-hmm. access to USC, all these different types of schools, right? And so it's kind of weird that you would see this at an elementary school. But the idea that somebody wants to, quote, pay for the best teacher. How do you determine what is the best teacher, though? That's the other thing, right? And so we were joking about that. Like, how do they bid? Right. It ends up becoming really a popularity contest the teachers. And it really does give unequal access to parents who have money mm-hmm. then. This is absolutely crazy. And so, principal, PTO, shame on you.
He was a fifth grade teacher for nearly 30 years in Milwaukee Public Schools. He was also a community activist. He was the president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association. He was also the founding editor of Rethinking Schools. He is now running for the citywide seat on the school board in Milwaukee Public Schools. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Bob Peterson. Bob, welcome.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So all of this work, 30 years, Rethinking Schools, MTA, isn't it time for retirement?
Well, officially I'm retired, but I'm an activist at heart. And since I devoted my entire adult life to public education, I feel I can still give a lot back to the public schools and the children of Milwaukee and hopefully the entire state.
Yeah, I've just, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, people are like, boy, does this guy's really busy. But I mean, this is, you know, you started getting at it. So, I mean, why run for school board?
Well, based on my experience, my commitment, the relationships I've developed over the years with activists, parents, and teachers and community activists, you know, I think I'm really well positioned to help ensure that all children in Milwaukee, in every neighborhood, every zip code, every school, get the public education they deserve. And unfortunately, due to a variety of factors, some of which are in control of the school board and some of which aren't, that's not the case right now in Milwaukee. And it's, the children of Milwaukee deserve as good a schools as the best schools in the rest of the state. And there's some really good schools in Milwaukee, but there's a number of schools that are struggling. And quite frankly, I see all the schools in the state, virtually all the schools, underfunded and in need of more resources.
Yeah, and that, holy crap, we could definitely talk about that. But I mean, in Milwaukee, right? I mean, we know, you know, it's 30 plus years as the, you know, the experiment city with vouchers because of quote the most horrendously failing public schools in the country. You know, so there's a narrative out there that I'm sure is a challenge, but. Yeah, I mean, how do you go up against that narrative when you talk to people, when you say, no, Milwaukee actually has great public schools?
Yeah, and that's one thing I say. There's a whole variety of great public schools. Milwaukee public schools has the largest footprint of Montessori schools. There's 8 public Montessori schools that have long waiting lists. Milwaukee public schools teach kids in many languages. I say, come to Milwaukee public schools, learn 2 languages. There are great developmental bilingual schools with Spanish. There's 2-way bilingual schools. I started one of those, sometimes called dual immersion. There's immersion schools in Spanish, French, German, Italian, and a small one starting in Chinese. It's really amazing. There's art schools. The problem is, however, that the media and those who would prefer to privatize not only schools but virtually every other public institution in our society have established that narrative that you've mentioned. And I say there's no such thing as a failing school. There's failing support to those schools. I mean, even in some of the most troubled schools in Milwaukee, there's great things going on. There's kids who are doing well. There's teachers who are excellent. But on the whole, you know, they might have a large percentage of students who have special needs. They might have a large, sizable percentage of kids who have been adjudicated. Now I'm talking about high schools. And we have to really understand that the Milwaukee Public Schools is the only institution in our city that has the capacity, commitment, and legal obligation to serve all kids. And if our society decides not to sufficiently support the public schools, to me, that means we're saying goodbye to the democracy or what we have left of democracy right now in our community.
Well, how does, though, as a school board candidate, right? I mean, this is a question. You're at a local government level on a school board. You're one voice. I mean, I don't think, you know, from the Busted Pencil listener, I don't think anybody's going to disagree with the bigger strokes that you've painted about, you know, the quality and why public schools are great. But what are going to be some challenges as an individual member if you get elected?
Yeah, well, the biggest challenge for both me as an individual member and as a board as a whole will be to assist the rest of the in unity with the rest of the state, figure out a way to get the budget, the school budget that Governor Evers has put forth, passed by the state legislature. Funding is a huge issue. And short of that, we have to look at the federal government. We have to prioritize within our own existing budget. And we'll have to consider perhaps a referendum like have been passed in many parts of the state next spring, April, when there's going to be a lot of large turnout due to the Democratic primary. So that's one challenge. Obviously, there's challenges internal to the district to decide between which programs get funding through the meager funds that we have, because there's lots of needs. There should be full-time art, music, phy-ed teachers. There should be librarians in every school. There should be more counselors and social workers. Class sizes should be diminished. And to choose between those things is going to be very hard. We'll have different people advocating justly for each one of those, and there's not enough money to go around at this point. And so we have to then look outside and provide leadership and along with community leaders, unions, teachers, parents, students especially, to demand the schools that our kids deserve.
Well, and you come back, you know, to get there, though. I hear this, and I see it on social media. I hear it in Wisconsin. I see it outside of the state of Wisconsin that, you know, we know a lot of the issues. As you said, there is no such thing as a failing school. You know, communities have allowed, or I actually like to say politicians have allowed schools to fail because I think they're largely responsible. But then with that, though, the funding, you know, okay, Bob's for more funding. My question is, for what?
Right. Well, I'll talk about some very specific things besides those things which I mentioned. I mean, I think one thing we need to do is make sure that our employees feel that it's worthwhile to have a career in education. And that means knowing that as one progresses through the years of teaching or counseling or whatever, that you have a salary schedule that keeps up with at least inflation and helps you live a life which makes teaching worthwhile. You know, people don't go into teaching for money. People go in because they have a passion for helping people. But in order to sustain quality teachers, there is a financial cost. This is especially true in our attempt to recruit teachers of color, which is a huge priority in my thinking for the district. Our district is overwhelmingly kids of color, and they will succeed better if they have more teachers who look like them in front of them. And that's not to say white teachers or teachers of different races can't connect to students of different races, but it is an essential ingredient. I also think there are some things that won't cost a lot of money that are really necessary. And one is the fact that our students deserve to learn about and study and be motivated to act on the question of climate justice and climate change. Recently there was an international strike of students demanding attention by adults to this issue. And I think it's high time that school districts, unions, teachers, professional associations, along with students, climate activists, put their heads together and really talk about what are we going to do to integrate climate justice issues into all curricular matters. And finally, I say one of the huge issues in any large public school system is the issue of discipline and respect And with that, I think we can do things that are cost effective, that around culturally relevant curriculum, anti-racist teaching, and what's called restorative practices, the restorative justice. Some teachers with huge class sizes and ruly kids resort to discipline techniques that are very punitive and not that effective in the long run or even in the short run. And there's ways that we can help those teachers. There is a cost involved in some professional development and so on, but those are some of the things that can be done in a fairly cost-neutral way. And so if we are committed to really helping our kids, we have to have adults around them that connect to their lives, that make learning meaningful and engaging, and has a way of building respect and running a classroom that's well managed with respect.
We are talking to Bob Peterson, candidate for citywide seat on Milwaukee Public Schools. Bob, talking about money, and we're talking about funding, and I've put forth this general sense that one of the biggest wastes of money, you know, and a lot of people say public schools waste money. And I typically will come back, no. But on this one, high stakes standardized testing, accountability, what should we do with it?
Well, we should do the best to limit it, if not get rid of it. I think the policy of high stakes standardized testing has been a disaster for our children and for our schools. It's been used in a punitive way. It's straitjacketed teachers. It's dumbed down the curriculum. It's limited the curriculum. I mean, there's a whole, it's a swamp, and our students are drowning in it. Wisconsin, and the United States, has the most tested kids in the world. And what do we have to show for it? Very little, as far as I'm concerned, except reasons to close schools and punish teachers and in districts. And that's unacceptable. Now, let me be clear.
Okay.
I believe that there should be assessment and there should be tests. Teachers invented tests, you know. But what's the purpose for it? And right now, the purpose and what's the consequence of those things? And I agree with you 100% in terms of costs and the negative impact. But certainly, we want teachers and students to know how well students are progressing. And there's a variety of assessment forms that can be used that are much more connected to actual teaching, and can describe much better what students need than the math standardized test. Certainly parents want to know. I know as a teacher at Fratney School, as a fifth grade teacher, we had student-led conferences with parents, and students had to develop a whole presentation about what they were learning and what they had challenges on. That kind of presentation parents really liked. They felt they got to know their kids better in terms of what their challenges were. And then, of course, our broader community wants to know about how well our students are doing. But that can be done much short of mass standardized tests for everybody. There can be, you know, select populations that are tested occasionally that reflect on a national scale how certain schools are doing, and that's fine. The thing that so annoys me is our society can be data driven,
right.
And it reduces kids' intelligence to a 2-digit number. I say no. We have to be child driven. We can be data informed, and we need some data. We need, if you don't understand data, you can't expose inequality. You can't show the need for certain changes.
Right.
But to be data driven is a disaster, and let's save money that way.
Well, at this point, too, I would have, you know, I'm going to keep putting forward that we already have the data. We already know what it shows. And at this point,
yeah,
spending any more money telling us that we have, quote, a gap or whatever you want to call it is a waste of money. Let's start moving that money in directions, like you said, curriculum liberation, curriculum climate change.
Yeah.
You know, let's look at this. You made mention of Fratney School. Now, that's the school, La Escuela Fratney, which you co-founded. What were some lessons you learned working there?
Well, one lesson right from the beginning was the power of parents and teachers and community working together. The school was going to be raised at first and then turned into a school that was run by administrators to help teachers that weren't effective. And we, as a group in the River West neighborhood in Milwaukee, came together by the name Neighbors for a New Fratney. We held a whole community campaign, organizing campaign, and convinced the school board, of, even though the superintendent was opposed to it, convinced them to allow us to start this new school, a public school based on a whole language approach to teaching of reading, social justice, and two-way bilingual. That means half of the kids have Spanish as their home language, half of the children have English as their home language. And what we, so one, power of parent, community, educators working together. Another very important issue was that if a school is going to be successful, there has to be a common mission that's embraced by all the staff at the school. And we started that way. It was a problem, quite frankly, because the way most staffing was taking place back then was through just strict seniority. We went to the union and worked with the union to get a memorandum of understanding so that there would be site-based hiring. And it was really helped us make sure that the teachers coming into the school believed in the mission of the school. And interestingly enough, that practice became universal throughout the whole district once a few of our schools experimented with this and other teachers and schools learned about it. And I'd say that the final thing is there's a real need for ongoing staff development in any school. I mean, we were strong when at the beginning, and then as some staff moved on and new staff came on, we saw the challenges of helping the new staff become part of the school, know the mission, and improve their skills. And that basically what you want is a whole school to be a community of learners, which requires the leadership to be a shared leadership model.
Well, in everything you're talking about, whether it's the Fratney School, the curriculum, I mean, it comes back, though, to, and I have to ask this question, you know, were the founding editor of Rethinking Schools. And for all of my social justice colleagues, there probably isn't one go-to source like Rethinking Schools is for us who really want to engage in that. What's happening there?
Well, Rethinking Schools started on my kitchen table with an Apple IIe computer and a can of rubber cement. It was a newsprint tabloid. We published it. We wanted a voice for educators that looks through at education through two lenses. One, an anti-racist social justice lens, and secondly, a lens from the classroom. So often, policy is made by people who last experience in the classroom was when they left 12th grade, and they don't really know what's going on. And so that was our motivator. It's a nonprofit, and it's been going now for 32 years. We publish a whole variety of books. We got on the national level, and when in 1992 we published a book called Rethinking Columbus during the quincentennial of this Columbus and the European invasion of the Americas. And ever since then, we've been one of the, I think, most adamant and well-known supporters of this notion that students should learn about social justice issues. Students should be taught critical teaching in multiple perspectives and encouraged to use their power, their agency, to try to affect the world in which they live.
Well, then putting that together, you putting the school, all of that work, it keeps coming together. The hard shift, but you've been out on the campaign trail now for a while. What are you hearing that people are going to want from you?
Well, I think people
can
have
you
really
deliver?
Yeah, it's going to be a challenge. I mean, one thing I know, though, in my whole adult life has taught me this, whether it was starting Rethinking Schools or organizing around desegregation way back when or the La Scuola Fratney, is an individual can't do it alone. And when I was elected president of the union right after Walker dropped his bomb on public sector workers and the children of the state, I knew that one person, no matter what I believed in, couldn't succeed at organizing. And so I'm a strong believer in working with community groups, working with teachers and the unions, working with other board members and the business community, the religious community, civic groups, to really have a conversation and not just converse about what we need. Because as you say, a lot of it is already known. The question is, can we build the political will and a political movement, an educational justice movement in the city and in the state and in the nation to really redirect priorities and transform our public schools. Because even the best public schools, the most well-financed in our country, oftentimes don't really teach kids to know the true history of our country, the multiracial narrative of this quest for social justice, which I believe is a strong tradition in this country, which doesn't really come through in most history textbooks. So what I'm saying is we're going to have to do it together, and I believe that with strong leadership, we can make a lot more progress than we've made in the past. I think we're on that verge of seeing a renaissance in the public education, and I want to be part of it and one of the leaders of that movement.
Well, you sold me and you got me, so now the question is, where do I go? How do I find out? How do I participate? How do I help Bob Peterson in this quest for the school board of Milwaukee Public Schools?
Well, thank you for asking. The easiest way would be to go to my website, which is www.bob4mps. And at that site, a person could sign up to get a yard sign. They could sign up to help canvas. If you live outside the city, you could sign up to press the donate button and help donate to my campaign. Being a citywide candidate, I have to raise a lot of money to put out mailers to tens of thousands of people, and any support whatsoever would be appreciated.
So that's www.bobformps.com. Check it out. Go there. And I also see you have an endorsements page, and yeah. I want to let you know that you have the Busted Pencils endorsement, and you know how you got that? Because at the end of every interview, when we like the interview, we say, Bob Peterson, you have truly busted pencils.
Great. I truly appreciate that support.
We are Busting Pencils!
Welcome back to the show, Joanna Rosato. Joanna, what's up?
Hey, Tim.
Hey,
I'm doing great. How are you?
Well, I'm excited to talk to you because this is a new segment for Busted Pencils. Check out the name. You're educated. I'm educated. We're educators. And what do? We talk about education. So this is now the Joanna and Tim Educated Educators Talking Education.
I love it.
Can you handle it?
I can handle it. And I think it's going to be really great for our listeners.
Awesome. So, in fact, you were over the weekend talking education on the Earl Ingram Show, which is part of Real Resistance Radio that airs Busted Pencils. What were some of the topics that came up there, the education-wise, on? And that was the Educators Amplified 2.0.
That is right, Educators Amplified 2.0. Well, we started out the second season talking about education and elections. Because we're always moving towards some new election,
right?
And we've had some, and so some of it was just informational and foundational about like why things are important, and then we started to push and kind of get at some questions around like, are elections enough? Is it enough for educators and education supporters to just solely be focused on elections?
Or are there some other things we could be doing? So what do you mean by that, right? Because I think I know where you're going, but I mean, because obviously elections matter, because for me, when I look at the disaster that we're currently in, particularly as teachers in the classroom, we are here as a result of politicians and not teachers. So elections matter. We seem to not understand how to get rid of the politicians that keep making a mess of our lives. But when you say more than elections, what else would we be doing?
Well, I think we really need to work as educators and with our allies to present politicians and the general public with clear and real choices. You know, overall, you'll hear that people will say that there's strong support for public schools,
right?
And we're even starting to hear that they're turning the tide on teachers, that there's strong support for public school teachers. And I think what I'm getting at is that And I believe that. I think that people are out here supporting us. However, I don't think that just elections present our supporters and people with clear choices on what could really be done in order to improve schools.
Well, I'll go at this. For me, when you say this, the first thing I come at this is to say, first of all, don't assume party means pro-public education. Right? I mean, you know, and we can take this a whole bunch of different ways, but, you know, just at the national level, Democrats for Education Reform, look at the disaster Rahm Emanuel, a Democrat coming out of the Obama administration, did in Chicago. Look at the disaster Arne Duncan, a Democrat, as the Secretary of Education at that level, did. And so, you know, people will tend to push on me because I criticize Democrats and I wouldn't say sometimes criticize, but I like to push sometimes Democrats, particularly Democrats, if they're going to be pro-public school. I want to know what it is you mean when you say you're pro-public school. And so I'll give you another example and let you comment on this. So I'm a Democrat. I'm for public education, and I believe we should have more money. And I'm always like, for what? And people just kind of give me that dumb look like, well, Tim, what do you mean for what? Public schools need more money. I'm like, well, yeah, but go ahead.
Right. Well, that's something that you talk a lot about on the show, and is let's examine what we're spending money on now. And back to, like, party, even when there are Democratic candidates that are supportive of public education, what I can tell nationally is they're maybe moderate at best. You know, that there hasn't been a real progressive education champion out here.
Thank you.
As long as I've been teaching.
Right. Thank you. And that's for me, that's the difference. A progressive candidate for public education. Okay, you're a Democrat, but are you progressive? And people are like, well, what do you mean? And so what would a progressive candidate for public education look like for you?
Well, it would have someone who really believes that the educators themselves should be leading the profession, that policy should only be set or even suggested if that is what's coming out of the body, you know, of academia related to education, if that was what was being suggested by, you know, professors and researchers, so I guess that's just what I said, and from actual practitioners, I think it would look like that's where the ideas would be coming from. I think it would also be someone who is truly child-centered. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a bridge between not just academics, but really looking at the health and well-being of children.
Mm-hmm. I see, for me, I don't disagree with you, but I would go and say, if you're a progressive for public education and you're running for public office, the first thing I want to hear out of your mouth is that you don't know the answer. And
right.
That, in fact, if you really, you know, and then I want to hear the next thing, I'm going to be working fully with teachers, with researchers, with parents and communities, because that's where the information really is. That's what I need out of whether it's a progressive, I just need a public figure who's going to decide to dabble in public education to just come right out and say, I don't know. You know, because there isn't right now public education, and this is my I hate this part about public education. Every candidate has to have some position on public education, whether it's for or against, to get elected. And then when we look at them, at least the ones who are against public education, I'm okay with people who come out against public education because I know where they are. I'm always afraid of the pro-public education people when they don't tell me what it is they're going to do, or if they're not humble enough to say, I don't really have the skill set to have really good education policy, other than to have the skill set that I need to go out and find the right people. I need educated educators.
But that's why the issue is complex, because there has been so much damage done over the past 20 years that there are things that sound reasonable and like they would be for kids that actually aren't. You know, things like related to accountability.
Right.
And so there's a part of me, Tim, that I'm not going to go maybe as hard on them. I mean, that's where it goes back to where you're like, I don't know, and I'm going to ask somebody. The problem has been that so many people are like, oh, that sounds good to me and my ideology, so I'm okay with it, without really understanding what it means. They're almost understanding that translation needed. You know, that students first, in some ways, depending on what companies it's associated with and what, you know, political action groups it's associated with, actually might not be a great thing.
Right. Pull the onion layers back and get at what we're really talking about. You know, a new craze right now is, quote, high quality curriculum. And it's the biggest social justice movement to hit public schools. And I keep going, wait a minute.
Oh, so there's products.
Yeah.
There's products that are out there that are there's
so high quality, you know, and we should all be in the business of making sure that all kids, particularly poor kids, get high quality curriculum. And so you, as you just said, right, given that to my next door neighbor who might not be an educator, they go, yeah, that makes sense to me. As you just said, that's common sense. Why shouldn't all kids have great curriculum? And so the conversation stops. But then this is where you'd say, where you and I step in and go, hold the phone, because that's actually code for a certain curriculum, typically sold by a or two companies, and it's typically then promoted as research-based. And when we actually look at the research-based, there's actually no research-based there. It's just a stamp that was put on to sell curriculum. And so now I'm sitting there saying high-quality curriculum is just the newest way to sell poor people products they don't need.
Well, and just even listen to that, though, of seeing like high-quality curriculum would be what students need, this really external thing,
right,
instead of the really internal thing of a high-quality professional, a highly trained, highly experienced, fully competent and capable professional.
Well, and that's why, you know, an educator matters. And, yeah, that's the other part, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's so offensive when you say curriculum is the solution, because I look at curriculum and go, without a teacher, without a professional who knows how to breathe life into curriculum, curriculum is an inanimate, worthless object, except if you're a company pumping, using a politician as your front to push that curriculum on top, onto schools, onto kids, onto teachers, and in the same time then deprofessionalizing those teachers. That's why, Joanna, I am so excited for this segment. It's going to be awesome, because there is just nothing the two of us can't talk about. So, Joanna Rosato, my fellow educated educator, thanks for talking education and, of course, for busting pencils.
Thanks, Tim.
Time now for our weekly salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zinn.
Education can and should be dangerous.
My thanks to Bob Peterson, Joanna Rosato. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to bustedpencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.